Funny name. Funny guy. Very good producer. And it's, you know, in a band like us, you need someone that can really be decisive and be outside the band, be objective. And he made decisions that normally would take us 2 or 3 hours of discussion happen just like that. And that's very good, you know, with a band like us especially.
Two or three hours of discussion. When have we ever had that?
Every rehearsal we've ever had.
So you didn't invite me.
You know, when you're doing stuff in the studio, it's so easy to get wrapped up in what you're doing yourself. You don't see the bigger picture. That's why the guy the other side of the control room, you have to know that his decision and his evaluation of what you're doing is the most important thing, because he hears everything. So when you've got a guy like Bob the other side, and he comes back with a point to make, it's generally the right thing to do, and it happens, as Roger says, immediately. You don't waste time. You don't waste 3 or 4 hours going over something which isn't going to work. You'll say, I don't like it, it's not working. And you go, okay, and you change it. And that's why it's important.
His attention to detail is incredible. For example, he would say to me, when you inhale, can you do it with more pathos between lines? Incredible.
Specifically, I think he's super strong on pre-production, which was great because, like Ian was saying, he's very quick to say, here's what I think should change or not change. And during the performances, we didn't waste a lot of time just doing endless takes. He would say, I got this, I need that, I need that, we're done. Okay, let's move on. And that's great to compact the amount of time you spend in the studio.
He's got a great idea of how music should resolve. One of his great things, this bit's all right, but it doesn't resolve. I want a resolution. And it's something musicians never think about. You know, you play, oh, this is great. But he sees it, you know, you want to give the people some closure on this little bit. And he was great for that. He was great for when we made the record, because it made us think, yeah, what's the point of this bit? You know, and we'd close it down or throw it out, yeah.
Yeah, we don't actually write songs. They come out of playing, they come out of jamming. The fingers write them, if you like. And that can be an endless process, because all you're doing is having a bit of fun, and when you're having fun, you don't want to stop having fun. And at some point, that fun, that playing, has to kind of congeal itself into a recognizable piece of music that we normally call songs. But it doesn't really come from the head. It comes from everything: the instinct, the body, the fingers, the playing, the singing. It's just it's what feels good. And it's very difficult to define what a Deep Purple song is. It's whatever we do, actually. We write the rules.
His job is to pull the best out of us and capture it and tell us when we've gone through that best. Because, you know, if you get something in the first 1, 2, 3 takes, that's as good as it's going to be. You might get it more perfect, but it won't be as good. It'll have that something missing that excitement of the first 1 or 2 takes gives you. I mean, my whole time in the studio in Nashville was 10 days. And that was from getting the drums in, getting a sound, recording the tracks. Now that, I haven't done a record that quickly since the old days, you know, when we used to go in and do it because we had the knowledge of what the songs were, which was, Steve said, the pre-production. But Bob just ran us through it like this. Okay, that's good enough, we got that, you don't need to do any more.
One of the questions I get asked a lot is, do we play live in the studio? Especially in these days of computer technology, it's very easy to, everyone do their single performances and it all kind of jigsaws together. But the answer to that, we play live in the studio, and most of what's on the tracks is what was originally recorded at the time we recorded it. And that gives it a bit of freshness, it gives it a movement that you can't get if you're being very precise. So to me, that's very important.
Yeah, it's a cohesion. Yeah.
For example, there's a section on the instrumental section on the album, which we couldn't overdub if we had to. I mean, it was just literally improv'd everybody at once. You know, there was no click track, no nothing to go on. So that had to be a moment that we all got together.
Yeah.
Well, more than a moment. It was minutes of the album. And I think it's very, very live. The entire band was there playing every song.
When Bob came to see us, he came to see a show, and we had a meeting the next day, and what impressed him on stage was the spontaneity of the stage act, that the things happened and you feed off each other, especially Don and Steve. And he had this idea in mind that he just wanted to capture that. It's very difficult to organize spontaneity.
Difficult to organize anything. We'd have been retired years ago if we could have planned it.
But you know, he gave us his impetus, and actually it was the very first take, whatever it was. He went, that's fine, that's what I want. You know, Nashville is a great town because it's not just a country town. People think of it because it's synonymous with country music. And of course, there's a lot of country music there, but in the last 10 or 15 years or so, it's really become a music town, and you'll find rock and roll, jazz, singer-songwriter, all kinds of music there. It's a very vibrant musical community. There's actually very few places like that I can think of left in the world, where there's so many studios still working, and so many musicians all congregated in the same place.
And bar bands, they've got the best bar bands in the world.
Yeah, and they play for nothing, they play for tips. No, don't get any ideas.
Well, that's pretty much the way it is in the U.S., actually, for most bands. But they have the infrastructure from the heyday of country. And those talented engineers, producers, technicians, they're all still there. And they want to keep working. And so they brought in artists from all around the world to record there. And well, like Roger said, it's a vibrant community, and it's certainly way beyond just the Grand Ole Opry.
Yeah. It was refreshing to go back to a place where music is what they do. You used to have New York, you used to have Los Angeles. These were big centers, and you had London, big centers of music, and it was all vibrant and it was exciting. Nashville is still that, because this is their industry, this is what they do. From writing it, to recording it, to performing, it's all there. Music. And it's not just one thing.
Mm. They call it country music, but I found out that term didn't come into use till about 1971. Before that, all the music coming out of Nashville was called rockabilly. Yeah. And really, it's kind of the home of rock and roll. You know, Elvis recorded in Memphis and in Nashville. And the distinction wasn't made till then.
Yeah.
And when you go and see some of these country bands, you suddenly realize they're playing 3-minute songs. And, you know, they built the industry up to what it is. You know.
We've done a cover. We haven't decided on the final lineup of tracks yet.
That one.
It'll be survival of the fittest. We will be very cruel, and we will select the best tracks to make the best album. And we'll all have different ideas about it, but we'll come to a decision, and that's what it'll be.
When we did that track, Ian wasn't in my cans, so I didn't know what the song was. I was just following the chords. I thought, I think I know this. What is it? And it wasn't until later that day I found out what we were playing.
You know, I don't think we needed it. The industry was going through a big change. It used to be called the business, right? But it's the industry now, so. We had enough material, and there was a great freshness. We play together every night, 5 cities a week. And we talk about this all the time, this sort of spontaneity. We'd go crazy if we did the same thing every night. So there's a great deal of spontaneity that happens during the show that keeps us alive. We didn't feel the need for any new material. Plus, everyone was confused. What to make a record for? You know, I mean, you know, who knows what a record is anymore? It's a different kind of thing. The whole world has changed. And suddenly, we got this feeling that it was necessary to get some new material. And it only crept up on us in the last year or so, because we were mixing around old stuff and recent stuff. There are four elements to a Deep Purple show: old, new, and improvisation, and something else, whatever you can think of. And we suddenly felt the need to refresh the show with new material, and that's why it came upon us, I think, this idea of doing a new record.
It was a totally different feeling 3 years ago. It was mooted that we should maybe go in the studio. Nobody really had the desire to make a record. So if you don't feel like you should do it, whatever you came out with wouldn't probably be very good. You have to want to do this. And it came to the time where we wanted to do it. And I think we got something very good.
Some people say that the whole concept of doing an album is kind of old-fashioned. That it's now down to the song or a few songs and so on. But to me, an album is it's almost like a journal of the state of the band at the time you did it. And every album we've made is a kind of snapshot of that time. And I think we were ready to do this. And I think the music on it is very recognizable as Deep Purple, and yet it's like nothing we've ever recorded before. And I think that's because there was such a long gap between albums. We were really itching to do something now, and that's the best way to do it.
Roger's right about that. You know, people want to grab, oh, what's the play track? What's the lead track? What are the two, three best tracks on the album that we can promote and everything else? I mean, there's something we don't see. Our view of it is probably far too subjective anyway. So the collection of music represents how we are at this particular time. And we've all got different ideas on what tracks are this, that, and the other, our favorites, or we don't have favorites anymore, but appreciation, you know. So it's just a collection of work that represents how we are at this moment.
The state of the band. In fact, the state of the band was Tennessee at the time.
Pun not intended.
Oh, I get it.
I'm just saying it's because it's true.
Oh, that was a good title, wasn't it, for the album? Anyone for Tennessee?
This YouTube, I mean, I use YouTube. If I've got a curiosity about a certain song or an artist, you can easily get on and find out about it. But on stage the other night, we were playing away, and I was thinking, there's nothing quite like real people on a real stage with a real audience. There's a sense of occasion there that YouTube can never capture. And people getting up, getting babysitters, getting cars, making all the arrangements, buying tickets and coming to a show. You know, we really appreciate that. You know, we made the effort to get there, and they made the effort to get there. And between the audience and the band, you have an experience that no TV or camera can ever capture. It's live, it's a magic thing.
You know, when I was a kid, waiting for Christmas, it was that anticipation of the present you were going to get at Christmas. And this built up and this built up till the day, and you couldn't wait. And I remember one Christmas I was looking around and I found my present before Christmas. And I was really happy that I got the present I wanted, but then Christmas was not so exciting anymore. And it's the same thing when you make a new record. The fans have this build up of anticipation about what they want they want it. Now, if it all leaks out in little bits and pieces at different concerts, and all that excitement, all that wonderful thing just goes away, you know? And that's really sad. The anticipation, the excitement of getting something new is just thrown out the window. So on that level, I really dislike the internet for doing that. You know, I think once you've got this new piece of art in front of you, the first time you put it on your player should be the first time that you really get into it. Whereas having all these terrible live versions captured on telephones and little video things, it completely destroys that build up to something special, and that's sad.
And another thing, just briefly, because Roger mentioned babysitters. Well, being a young father, he would, but
old
you know. But in actual fact, personally, I'd rather the babysitters came to the show and the parents stayed at home. But I mean, it's just another point of view. You know. I think we always had a placid kind of audience. I have to say, the Deep Purple crowd was always like very spiritually intense with the band, with a lot of concentration because of what was going on the stage and a lot of spiritual contribution. I never really saw much in the way of physical activity. I mean, to be honest, going back, they were talking about the 60s and the early 70s. I mean, most of the audience was stoned and lying on their back on the floor. I mean, and there was big gaps. It wasn't as crowded as our memories make us think. I mean, it was just a lot of good vibes. And I think that's what is still there, is a good vibe. It's a lot more crowded now, in fact. But the vibes are still there. I don't know about elbows.
I can tell you from experience that if you want to get pushed around or see where that's happening, it's always 7 to 8 rows back, standing audience, near the center. They never go farther back because they won't have an audience. They won't be as lit up. And they never come too far forward because the real hardcore fans are there. So the pushing and shoving and the mosh pitting, if there's ever going to be any.
Like used to happen on stage.
Okay. Yeah. But it's always 7 to 8 rows back from and very near the center.
And it's usually a minority of 5 or 6 stupid people. And they involve everybody else around them. You know, most people are there to do exactly what we're doing and have a good time.
Yeah, they go by the name of security people.
Oh.
It's amazing how exactly that location. I've been looking at the audience for decades, and nothing else to do.
No. He's just a lad. Mere decades.
That dry English wit never gets old.
Yeah, we played a gig in Moscow a couple of weeks ago, and I don't think there was one person in the audience that was over 20. It was all teenagers. I mean, maybe there's some few older people at the back, but it's, you know, one of the questions you get asked a lot is, are you tired of playing Smoke in the Water? And you don't get tired of it because you're experiencing it anew every time you play to a young audience, because they're probably the first time they've heard it live. So you experience it together, and it's always good fun when you play to young people like that. Older people tend to stay at the back and they go, oh yeah, I remember that one. But the younger crowd is really, you know, and I think seeing 10-year-olds, all their fathers bringing 10-year-olds and 12-year-olds, it's a great feeling to see that your music is getting through to that age group.
I've never heard anyone in this band since it started think along those lines. I mean, it's very rewarding and flattering and a great honor to think that you're looked upon in those terms. But to be honest, if you heard the conversation in the dressing room, you'd be hearing talk about football and other things like football and and football.
By football, he means soccer. American translation subtitles.
Yeah, we all have our heroes, and I think all our music comes from music that went before us. So it's really just the spirit of music that flows through us to someone else. Well, I can't feel responsible for it. I'm just, you know, having a good time doing what I do. And when people say, oh yeah, thank you for your music, well, who do I thank for my music? I think, you know, I thank the people that went before me, the people in the 50s, the people I grew up with, the Chuck Berrys and Little Richards and Elvises of the world.
And to be honest, somebody pointed out to me once, do you realize, they listed all the heavy metal bands and everything else, you're responsible for all this. I said, well, all I can do is apologize. I'm sorry.
So. I once saw Duke Ellington being interviewed by a BBC arts program, and the interviewer said, Duke, you are now commonly acknowledged as one of the greatest 20th century composers. And he just went, I'm just a jive time piano player having fun. Mm. That's what he said, and he meant it.
Yeah. I think people will be very surprised at how little individual artists actually think about themselves that way, or what their effect is on other people. When, you know, most people, when they pick up an instrument or pick up a paintbrush as a kid, they do it because it makes them happy. Now, if you're really lucky, that happiness will earn you a living and give you a career, but you're still happy doing it. And so you don't think of it beyond that. If success comes along and you actually get involved with some other great players, it just makes you happier. That's all there is to it. Mm. And you don't analyze it beyond that. People outside it, they analyze it that way. How does it feel to be a legend? Yeah. Well, you know, I'm not a legend when I'm putting the trash out at home. When I'm going to the supermarket, I'm not a legend. It's, you know, your perception is totally different within yourself. It really is.
As an observer, I see the way that trends come and go, you know, from fashion to music fashion. And I do hope, Roger mentioned how many young people have been showing up at the concerts. And it's great that this kind of rock is being handed down to the next generation. And I hope that it becomes fashionable again for bands to sound undoubtedly live, you know, to where, like when somebody goes to a Deep Purple show, nobody's sitting there saying, do you think they taped this? That's not, yeah. There's so many spontaneous things and just the whole edge of the show is, I mean, every bit of it is happening right in front of your eyes. So I do hope that that becomes a fashionable thing for young people to emulate.
Yeah. We've got a new sound guy with a new sound mixer, state-of-the-art Soundcraft digital mixer. And he said the whole thing really, with new mixers, is set up for Pro Tools under the stage. You know, that you feed the show in through the PA on Pro Tools and...
it comes out.
People are miming.
A recorded version and everyone mimes to and dances
people
to.
People are miming, you know.
Yeah.
And it's disgraceful, really.
I don't have a problem with the miming thing if they tell you that. You know, if you say, this is a pre-arranged show, it'll be the same every night, other than the fact somebody might fall over dancing, but the music has got nothing to do with live at all. But when it's sold as a live show, then I have a problem, you know, because it isn't, and it's a con, basically.
I think maybe music's become a sort of television event.
Yeah.
And we always remember in the 70s, TV and music didn't go together at all. Because the sound we were making, you couldn't imagine coming out of those little speakers in the television set.
Being enjoyed by one or two people on their own.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. You know, rock is really, it's live and it's loud and it's lots of people and it's a celebration.
You don't think Hendrix seemed totally natural on a daytime talk show doing one song with TV?
Oh, yeah, you got a point there. Yeah. Got a point there.
Necessary evil. There you go.
Yeah.
Good fun, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cameras.